Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Jack Merkinson, a senior editor at The Nation magazine, who talks about President Biden's contradictory and deadly Gaza policies that prioritize rhetoric over action. Jake Johnston, senior research associate with the Center for Economic and Policy Research, who assesses the chaotic situation in Haiti and efforts by the U.S. and other nations to intervene in the crisis they helped create. And Karen Bixler, an 81-year-old Vermont climate activist, who explains why she risked arrest by engaging in a civil disobedience protest action against the construction of the Mountain Valley Pipeline in West Virginia. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Weeks before India's next national election begins on April 19th, Prime Minister Narendra Modi implemented the strongly criticized Citizenship Amendment Act, which accords citizenship rights to religious minorities from surrounding Muslim nations like Pakistan and Afghanistan. It does not, however, protect Muslim minorities facing persecution. This is the first time India will use religion as a litmus test for becoming an Indian citizen. India's 200 million Muslims fear the act will lead to a new national citizen registry that will subject them to government discrimination and could lead to mass deportations and internment. Although first passed in 2019 by Modi's Hindu nationalist BJP government, the law provoked mass protests, which led to a delay in its implementation until now. Critics complain the law violates India's secular traditions and constitution, which date back to independence in 1947. Several Indian states run by opposition parties, such as West Bengal, pledged non-cooperation with enforcing the citizenship law. Four of America's giant Wall Street banks, J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, Citibank, and Wells Fargo, have abandoned the Equator Principles. Developed over 20 years ago, the principles set minimal industry standards and safeguards for financial institutions to address environmental and social risks in countries where they finance fossil fuel and mining projects. It's just one more sign that big finance is walking away from corporate agreements on best practices for screening investments to consider the impact on environment, social conditions, and good governance, or ESG. Republican Party-controlled states have increasingly attacked ESG standards and have pressured banks to invest heavily in fossil fuel projects, damaging the environment and exacerbating climate change. Although the Equator Principles are not enforceable, they serve as a baseline on environmental standards for 128 banks across the globe. The Guardian reports that these standards underpin finance deals for extractive, polluting industry projects. Adele Schreiman of the Sierra Club blasted the banks for, quote, yet another display of cowardice that shows how Wall Street is bending to pressure from climate denier extremists rather than upholding some of their most basic climate and human rights commitments. Medical practices are struggling to keep afloat weeks after a major security breach at a United Healthcare division that processes 15 billion insurance transactions a year. A ransomware attack on the United Healthcare's claims processing system halted the flow of information that enables physicians, hospitals, and other healthcare providers to get paid for their work. The American Prospect reports that growing numbers of cash-strapped physician groups are being forced to sell to healthcare giants, including United Healthcare, America's biggest health insurer. The Federal Department of Health and Human Services has launched an investigation into the late February hack of UHC's processing center. Parts of United Healthcare have now moved to exploit the crisis over missed medical reimbursements that their own security breach caused. The situation underscores the perverse state of affairs in which United Health, which made $371 billion last year, has profited from the desperation that the hacking of its computer systems inflicted upon the nation's healthcare system. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manso.
Less than one day after President Biden warned Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that his planned military offensive against Hamas in the southern Gaza city of Rafah, where more than a million Palestinian refugees have sought safety, would deepen the humanitarian crisis for innocent civilians there, the defiant Israeli leader restated his intention to proceed with an attack on the overcrowded city. As Israel's war in Gaza entered its sixth month, more than 31,600 Palestinian residents of Gaza have been killed, including some 13,450 children, following the October 7th Hamas terrorist attack that killed 1,200 Israelis and kidnapped 240 hostages. Earlier in a March 9th interview on MSNBC, President Biden warned the Israeli government that an assault on Rafah would cross a red line, but then immediately backed off an implicit threat to cut off supplies of U.S. offensive weapons deliveries. Talks on a proposed six-week Gaza truce and hostage release between Israel and Hamas have resumed after a months-long deadlock. Meanwhile, officials of the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification Global Initiative, or IPC, project that famine is imminent for 300,000 Palestinian civilians in northern Gaza by the end of May. And by mid-July, as many as 1.1 million people in Gaza could face severe levels of starvation, death, destitution, and acute malnutrition. Your reporter spoke with Jack Merkinson, a senior editor at The Nation magazine, who talks about President Biden's contradictory and deadly Gaza policies, which have prioritized rhetoric over action.
What we've been getting with increasing fervor, I would say, especially over the past month or so, is a ramping up of the rhetoric from the Biden administration, claiming to be concerned, claiming to be unhappy with the way that the Israeli government is indiscriminately massacring people in Gaza. So Biden's given an interview saying Benjamin Netanyahu's government is hurting Israel, and they're supposedly laying down this warning about Israel potentially invading Rafah, which is the city in the south of Gaza, where about 1.5 million people have sort of been trapped as the last supposed safe haven in Gaza. And so you're getting an increase in this kind of public presentation, along with the continuation of a steady stream of very clearly sort of leaked media reports saying that behind the scenes there's increasing frustration or anger or ire or whatever you want to call it. That is, you know, being sort of put forward to the American public and the global public, really. But at the same time, there continue to be essentially no red lines, really, that the Biden administration is drawing for Israel. And what I wrote about in my piece was that was this really, really striking dichotomy that happened in the same week. And in the same week, Biden gave his State of the Union address in which he said Israel has to protect civilians in Gaza, which was clearly meant to be this sort of ramping up of pressure on the Israeli government, et cetera, et cetera. And in that same week, the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Post published reports saying that the U.S. has approved more than 100 arms sales to Israel since October 7th, constituting tens of thousands of weapons in total, and that the vast majority of these arms sales have been sort of off the books because if they sell Israel a certain amount of arms, then they have to notify Congress. But if they transfer weapons, the value of which fall under a specific amount, then they don't have to notify Congress. So, you know, it's like if a bomb costs $10, they're making sure that they send it to Israel for $9.99, and then they don't have to tell Congress. So not only have they been flooding this war zone with weapons, and weapons that are essential for Israel's continuation of this assault, they're also doing it in a way that's clearly designed to evade public scrutiny and legislative oversight. And so the spectacle of this sort of increasingly dramatic, performative criticism of Israel on the one hand, and the depths of the financial, military, diplomatic assistance that the Biden administration has been giving Israel, on the other hand, really came together for me in these two different situations. And so, you know, watching that and seeing the United States go around and you know, pretending really to talk tough about Israel and, you know, vowing to build this pier in Gaza to get aid in because it's so committed to having aid in, you know, and knowing at the same time that this aid is necessary and this pier is necessary because the state that it is backing diplomatically, financially, militarily, you know, that's the reason that this humanitarian crisis that it claims to be responding to is happening. And it's responding to a crisis that has been caused in large part by its own weapons that it is sending to Israel to use against the people in Gaza. And so when you really start to think about that, as I say, the absurdity of that, the farcical nature almost of that, it really makes you feel a little crazy because we're watching a government, you know, have all these different workarounds and play all these different rhetorical games about a crisis that is being fueled by that very same government. It's really sort of beyond belief in a lot of ways.
That was Jack Merkinson, a senior editor at The Nation magazine and co-founder of Discourse Blog. Find a link to his recent Nation article titled "The Tragic Absurdity of Biden's Gaza Policies" by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Haiti, the poorest nation in the Western Hemisphere, has been gripped by an ever-deepening crisis and violence since the July 2021 assassination of President Jovenel Moise. After the president's death, acting Prime Minister Ariel Henry failed to control rising gang violence in the capital of Port-au-Prince and faced a crisis of legitimacy. Despite demands from Haiti's citizens for a national election, Henry betrayed his December 2022 pledge to hold a free, fair, and transparent general election in 2023, leading to a democratic transition of power by February 7th this year. With growing protests demanding Henri's resignation and gangs' takeover of 80% of Port-au-Prince, armed groups staged coordinated attacks on government buildings in the airport in early March with the goal of ousting Henri from office. From Puerto Rico, Henri released a statement on March 11th that he was willing to resign upon the formation of a transitional government backed by the U.S. That same day, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and foreign diplomats from France, Canada, and the CARICOM nations meeting in Jamaica announced support for the formation of a transitional Haitian presidential council composed of 7 voting members and 2 observers. A UN-backed plan to deploy 1,000 police officers from Kenya to help restore order in Haiti is on hold pending the formation of the transition council. Your reporter spoke with Jake Johnston, senior research associate with the Center for Economic and Policy Research, who discusses the chaotic situation in Haiti and efforts by the U.S. and other nations to intervene in the crisis they helped create.
The current crisis really kicked off on February 29th. And on February 29th, the disparate armed groups in the capital, estimates are around 200 of them, announced sort of an alliance. And that day began coordinated attacks against state infrastructure and institutions. So police stations, the national penitentiary, the airport. And that was a significant difference from what we've seen in the past, where these groups have been fighting largely each other over territory and access to different neighborhoods and routes. And so this is certainly a different dynamic than we have seen on the ground before. And certainly there is, you know, this climate of fear and unknown. I think it is important to note a few things. One is, as you mentioned, this has been building for some time. And in fact, the territorial fights that put large, densely populated civilian areas directly in the crossfire were extraordinarily violent. And those happened, you know, a year ago, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, 4 years ago, and got very little attention. So what we're really seeing now, again, is a different target and the state itself being targeted. So we're seeing big shootouts between armed groups and the police, as opposed to between two armed groups.
Alongside this violence, there was a recent meeting of representatives of the U.S., Canada, France, and the CARICOM nations in Jamaica with the goal of forming a presidential council after Haitian Prime Minister Ariel Henry resigned from office earlier this month. The status of his resignation is not quite clear, as you wrote about recently. But tell our listeners a bit about what these world powers have come together in Jamaica to do.
To provide a little context, while this began on February 29th and has continued since, Henri was out of the country and he had attended actually a CARICOM meeting that week and on that day was in Kenya to sign an agreement with the Kenyan government to bring 1,000 police to Haiti. And the armed groups in the capital were quite explicit that their, you know, ostensible goal in this activity was to force Henri from power. And certainly their attacks on the airport, which closed the airport to all travel and all airports in Haiti, have meant that the prime minister, as well as everybody else outside of Haiti or anybody in Haiti, right, has been unable to leave or get in. And so with that happening, the U.S. and other foreign powers, which had stayed very strongly behind Henri over the previous 30 months, even as Haitians from all stripes were arguing and making the case for the need for a presidential council or some new transitional governance structure to provide some balance. There's not a single elected official in Haiti right now. So all of the power had been consolidated under the prime minister, Henri. And so now we see this movement from the international community. Now that the situation has sort of exploded on the ground in a certain way, they moved against Henri and are pushing this new presidential council being negotiated, certainly with the involvement of Haitians. But the way it was set up sort of makes it seem, at the very least, that Haitians are basically submitting proposals to a board of foreign powers who are then choosing which one to follow. And in a country with a history of foreign interference and where foreign backing for the illegitimate Henri administration really pushed Haiti into this crisis, another government emerging solely based on, you know, the legitimacy coming from outside of Haiti is a serious concern and has made the exit to this crisis that much more difficult, right? People are negotiating now with a gun to their head, and that has given tremendous leverage to these international actors, for example, to impose conditions on participating in the council, including accepting the deployment of Kenyan police to Haiti. That is a condition to participate in this presidential council. Even if this new council out of CARICOM happens, it's not clear at all that those people with guns in the capital right now are going to accept that whatsoever.
That was Jake Johnston, senior research associate with the Center for Economic and Policy Research and author of Aid State, Elite Panic, Disaster Capitalism, and the battle to control Haiti. Find more analysis and commentary on the situation in Haiti by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The Mountain Valley Frack Gas Pipeline, being built through 303 miles of pristine Virginia and West Virginia forests and mountains, was all but dead until West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin forced through an amendment in the 2023 debt ceiling law that required completion of the pipeline, regardless of any regulatory or judicial rulings against it. Since then, work on the pipeline has gone on at breakneck speed to complete the project. The company first promised it would be done by the end of 2023, then spring of 2024, which is now somewhat in doubt. One reason for the delay is the ongoing nonviolent direct action protests blocking pipeline construction, sometimes more than one a week, organized by the group Appalachians Against Pipelines. The actions involve one or a few people locking down across access roads or directly to machinery used to cut through the mountains and under rivers, which activists charge endangers the drinking water of local residents and threatens landslides. In one of the latest actions, an 81-year-old woman from Vermont, Karen Bixler, who goes by the name River, locked down with a partner to a car placed across the access road to a major West Virginia worksite, closing it down for the day. Police charged the pair with one count of obstruction, a misdemeanor. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Bixler about her reasons for risking arrest in the action and what she hopes her protest will accomplish.
I've seen online videos of these people's actions, and I've been really impressed with them. And then last summer, I met a couple of people from the pipeline, and that kind of cinched it. Oh, and what really cinched it was they put out a call for old folks. So I was like, yeah, okay. Because sometimes there's actions, and I think, I don't know, I'll probably just get in the way because I'm not real agile. I can't, you know, move around real fast. So they put out a call for old folks, and I thought, okay, that's it. I'm going to this one. Basically, we blocked a road to a major work site. They're working on several sites at the same time, but this was one of the big ones. And we got there at 5 o'clock in the morning and locked down to a car that we had brought in and pretty much straddled the road so no vehicles could get up it. And we had people down below just telling people, you're not working today, site's closed. The good news down there is that the workers get paid day off when we do this. That makes it a little bit easier on everything because I always worry when we block people's access to their livelihood. Folks came up and held a rally and held banners. And then soon after that, a few police officers came and just kind of came up and wandered around and looked at the situation and looked at the lockdown and went back down to confer. And then a special team, an extraction team, came up and looked at it a little more carefully and went back down. We were singing songs and chanting chants and very upbeat vibe of the place. And then the extraction team came back and said, okay, folks, you all have to leave. And if you don't, we're going to arrest you. And you have 20 minutes to get out of here. So everybody gathered up all their signs and banners and went back down and rallied at the bottom of the mountain that we could still hear them sometimes. We could still hear shouts and music. So it was nice just knowing that our folks were near. I have some medical issues, and the street medics had talked to the captain and said, you know, they wanted to stay with me because they had concerns for me. And the captain said, no way, but he would get his EMTs there. So then we had another half hour wait until the EMTs rolled in. Then they took my blood pressure, which was a startling 220. Then I had three EMTs standing around me begging me, please, please, let us get you out of here. Let us treat you. This is not good. And then a young police officer begging me, please. At some point, I felt a shift in my body. And I thought, oh, this isn't good. I felt like I actually am going into a danger zone as far as my health is concerned. And so I unlocked and came away from it. Pat was still locked in, and then they started the actual extraction.
So, well, it was probably a good thing that you unlocked at that point. Were you disappointed?
In the first moment, I was very disappointed. I was very self-flagellating. Damn, you didn't do it. And then, you know, when I got back with my people and when I thought about it, I realized, of course, it was the right thing to do. One of the things I love about politics in this time is that there's more emphasis on taking care of yourself and knowing your own limits. And there's at actions, there's always the caveat of at any time, if this doesn't feel right, if it's not okay, you can depart. You don't have to stick something out just because you said, oh, I'm going to do this. And that attitude is very pervasive in this particular campaign. I mean, they're really aware of the fact that the pipeline's important and building community is more important.
As you know, the pipeline is billions of dollars over budget and years over its expected finish date. So do you think that by stopping work for, I guess, an entire day, that'll make a difference?
I think so, because it's an ongoing. They just keep coming back and doing something and stopping them again and stopping them again. And, you know, it's tremendously expensive for them every time they lose a day of work. It's just such a fragile, fragile landscape. It's really horrendous, the disregard for the natural world. And it's also really important to always keep in mind that it's part of something so much bigger. This isn't just a pipeline that happens to be going through causing environmental problems. It's part of an overall structure of extraction and exploitation that we see around the world. And it's all coupled. It's all connected.
That was 81-year-old Karen River Bixler of Vermont, who was arrested in a recent civil disobedience protest action against the Mountain Valley Pipeline in West Virginia. Learn more about the protests being organized by the group Appalachians Against Pipelines by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WXOJ in Florence, Massachusetts, KHOI in Ames, Iowa, KUGS in Bellingham, Washington, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.